this is Cameron Kuhn and Bob Dobbs, and we're starting the 48th episode of our dialogue revolving around my book on Trump and the tech body. And we're going to go into a quote on page 96. That's how far we got the last 2 weeks ago. But Cameron has brought up a quote from page 84, which did we talk about this quote? I don't think we did.
Just a little bit, but we really didn't sort of go into it.
Yeah.
One way to look at the quote is to see it in terms of the flow of the book. Another way is to take it out of the flow of the book and look at it and see what sense it makes.
Yeah. So it's from a guy named Tom Dilworth, who I don't know, but he spoke at a conference in Ottawa, 2002 or 3, and then they took the speaker's essays or lectures and made a book out of it called At the Speed of Light, There is Only Illumination. So it's a conference on McLuhan. The title is, at the time, At the Speed of Light, There is Only Illumination. The book comes out in 2004, and this quote is from the lecture talk by Tom Dilworth on page 33. So Dilworth mm-hmm. says, Tired de Chardin fell a trap of thinking there was a direction. Now, that's something you would say 1,000 times, right, at Epstein.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Newman, that means Cardinal Newman, right?
Right.
Newman fell into the same trap. Evolution is an unfortunate metaphor. Clock time is visual. Other cultures don't have it, and is useless even as a metaphor at the speed of light. So far, I agree with him. Under conditions of literacy, continuum makes sense, continuum in quotes. Acoustic man lives not in a continuum, but in a sphere without margin or center. Now, he's pretty well quoting McLuhan accurately. Maybe that's why I was struck by this guy's talk. He was actually referring to the basics accurately. You know what I mean? Because most people don't.
But I don't know that McLuhan would say that would talk about a sphere without margin or center. He certainly spoke about a sphere without margin, spoke about that a lot.
Yeah, and he said center's everywhere.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's absolutely correct. So it's not that the sphere has no margin in the structural sense. It's that the sphere, whatever margins it has to define it as a sphere, are also potentially centers.
Yeah,
right?
That's a very good point.
But what bothers me is that the very next line, he says, man the spheros. If you want to say that acoustic man lives in a sphere without margin or center, that means that he doesn't live in a sphere, because without a margin or center, there is no sphere.
Yeah, so actually he's now making a mistake.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, he's specializing, he's taking the cliche that McLuhan's pro-acoustic space and happy to go feudal and tribal and retrieve it. You know, that's where he's mm-hmm. screwing up, and he doesn't seem to have a sense of the tactility. So
right.
He says, under conditions of literacy, continuum makes sense. Okay, that's okay up to that point. Then he says, mm-hmm. acoustic man lives not in a continuum, but in a sphere without margin or center. You explain the limitation of that sentence. Then he has capitalized, man the spheros, or spheros, or spiro, man the sphere. Acoustic, mm-hmm. simultaneous man, which you're always talking about, is back together with a rush, : Humpty Dumpty. Now, that's okay, man the spheros, but you object to him hyphenating this man stuck in the spheros.
Sure, but also look at, the next thing he brings up is Humpty Dumpty. Now, Humpty is not all back together, right? Humpty,
yeah.
In order to, the difference between Humpty Dumpty and an egg on the one hand and an omelet on the other is that Humpty's fallen off the wall and is shattered and can't be put back together again, right?
Right, but McLuhan said that electric environment does put them back together, bypasses the king's bureaucrats. And
but he doesn't put them back together seamlessly, right? It's the, For McLuhan, the whole idea of coming down on one side of the visual acoustic metaphor ruins it.
Yep.
So what's happened here is that Dilworth is, as you said, he's going with probes, but those probes can't be taken as anything more than probes.
Yep. So, yes, he makes a mistake on the Humpty Dumpty, or he doesn't spell it out, the particulars enough. Then he says, at the speed of light, there is only illumination.
Right.
Tactile, smelling, hearing man senses no continuum. Spengler was right. Western man went down the hill and he disappeared.
Right. And that's all good. It's just that middle section where Dilworth has missed the complications in McLuhan.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So, for example, at the speed of light, there is only illumination. Well, no. At the speed of light, there's also complete disaster.
That's right. There's numbness, colossal numbness.
Correct. Blindness.
Yeah. So I have to look at his whole essay. Maybe he's trying to say that McLuhan had a way out in the cliche celebration of acoustic space, which is really silly. So I guess I like the quote because it was half right, and it mm-hmm. pointed out to people that there is no visual linearity. Visual linearity is not easily removed, and it's not necessarily ever removed. It's just part of the composite,
the
complex. But he's good at describing the other part better than most. But again, go ahead.
I would just point out that the phrase, the medium is the message, is a very traditional insight. And what the medium is the message says is that when you look at any opposition, let's say between linearity and circularity, what the two of them mean depends upon their relation, right? So later in the book, you'll be quoting McLuhan on there are only relations. And, so in order to understand what's meant by linearity and what's meant by circularity or simultaneity, you have to understand their relation in any given instance. And to understand them as a whole, you have to understand all of the different relations there could be between the two and what they would look like given all of those different relations. So any time anybody comes down on some, on some singular reading of what McLuhan's talking about, they're ignoring the very basic insight that the medium is the message.
Yeah. Correct. Okay, it actually reminds me of something. On Fake Explorations, Adam Pugin's Facebook group, Scott posted this statement. Isn't the fact that two-thirds of the trivium is constrained to only half the brain inherently unfair? Isn't the fact that two-thirds of the trivium is constrained to only half the brain inherently unfair? So Adam Pugin says it's not. Rhetoric equals right hemisphere. Dialectic equals left hemisphere. Grammar equals corpus callosum. So then Scott comes back to Adam. According to who? Mark Stallman? And Adam says... Because Adam works with Stallman a little bit. He's a member of that the board of that digital thing. And Adam says, no, according to me, meaning him. So then Scott says, well, I think before he said what I was going to read, I came in. And I said, no, you're both wrong. The trivium, and I have in brackets the Gutenberg galaxy, is left hemisphere. The quadrivium, in brackets, Understanding Media, the book, is right hemisphere. Both books form an apillion, and in brackets, a model for consciousness. Apillion is a model for consciousness. Then I said, Mark Stallman wouldn't know or understand any of this. He's stuck in the eye-ear. I had to take a smack at him. He's stuck in the eye-ear dialectic of the 50s. I mean, he left this group because I showed up. So, anyways, Mark Stallman wouldn't know or understand any of this. He's stuck in the eye-ear dialectic of the 50s. Then I say, the books from the medium is the massage on might be considered corpus callosum if we're lazy. But the actual output of McLuhan that would be more accurately labeled corpus callosum is every medium he engaged that wasn't a book per se, including the Monday night seminars. So then, let's see,
And is this on New Explorations?
Yeah, fake Explorations, not New Explorations, fake. It's Adam's Facebook group. It's just small.
Oh, on Facebook. Oh, that's why I haven't seen it. Okay.
Yeah. So I was wondering, what would you correct this? Is Adam on the right path by saying rhetoric equals right hemisphere, dialect is...
No. Your explanation was much better. Adam is taking left and right and center according to one relationship between them.
Yeah.
And that's what I was just saying, is that relationship is inherently plural. And so in order to understand the medium as a message, you have to understand that the medium is media.
Yeah.
And therefore, all of the things that are joined by media are inherently plural and can never be understood according to one relationship, and especially cannot be understood aside from relationship. So what you did was you pointed out absolutely correctly that the trivium and the quadrivium themselves are in dynamic relationship.
Yeah.
And that you, in order to understand, and I think you said that mind was equal to all of the relationships that the trivium and the quadrivium can take between themselves.
And yeah, I called it consciousness.
Yeah. I think that's a very good definition. What you could say is that if you take all of the ways in which the trivium can ground the quadrivium, and then you take all of the ways in which the quadrivium can ground the trivium, then that dynamic cloud is consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. So perfect. Yeah, so it's a nice formula I came up with, and I'm glad you get it. So Scott Talkington responds to what I said. He said, it's not a bad conjecture, but I haven't seen anyone make a case for it. The way McGilchrist sees it, and Scott's always quoting academics because he spent most of his life in universities. The way McGilchrist sees it, and also the way McLuhan seems to see it in Science of Media, meaning laws of media, is that the right brain, in brackets, the master, governs both grammar and rhetoric, while dialectic plays an intermediate role between them. This is why it doesn't need a ground. This is ridiculous, but
it is ridiculous. Yeah.
He's overcomplicating, but so he says. But we do know. So this is why it doesn't need a ground. But we do know that it's a left brain function in most people, and it's definitely not the corpus callosum. Then he says the corpus callosum is the direct connection to God in Michelangelo's painting. But perhaps the corpus callosum governs the ground characteristics for both grammar and rhetoric, and the hemispheres are figure. Way too complicated there, and maybe conceptual. Do you have a comment on that, what he says?
Well, just a huge amount of not very good thinking is the attempt to get around the missing link problem by generating words so that nobody notices the missing link by the time you get to the end of your paragraph.
Right. So then he later says, in relation to what I said, where I talked about, I guess, Gutenberg Gaussi and understanding media, he goes, right, they're books. their books, dot, 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 like the Bible, in brackets, says the guy who can't tell one Bible book from another. I don't know what that is referring to. Like the Bible, says the guy who can't tell one Bible book from another. Hey, Mom, my brain is a book written by some guy. Where's the light switch so I can read it? So that's silly. Or do you see something applicable in there in what he said?
No, I've kind of lost the thread.
Yeah. He always does that. He loses everybody. So then he then later has more to say. He says, the quadrivium are subjects, bodies of knowledge, or what Charles Peirce, you know, the guy from the 19th century,
yeah.
or what Peirce called symbols, in brackets, like a library, four divisions of thirdness. So he's bringing in Peirce concepts. The trivium are arts or capacities that are the triadic aspects of the logos. And then he names three words that Peirce uses as significant.
It's Peirce, by the way.
What did I say?
You're saying Peirce, but it's Peirce.
Okay, yeah. So he says there are triadic aspects of the logos that Peirce names. One, as significant, or the second point, representamen, and the third one is interpretant. So he says these three are parts of the triadic sign. No logos, no quadrivium. If there is a logos, you can make the quadrivium. Well, that might be interesting what he's saying there, but not enough definitions of logos or how he means it.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say what's needed there is to look at my post on McLuhan talking about the logos, which he did forever.
Yeah.
And you then see that it's a very, very complicated matter.
Right. So Scott is trying to complicate it by overlaying Peirce's concepts, which is not appropriate, I don't think.
There's nothing wrong with complication if it's done well.
Yeah.
Right? It's like somebody who's knitting something. Knitting can be very complicated, and if it's done well, then you get a very nice end product, a sweater or something like this. But if it's a complication that doesn't know what it's doing, you end up with something that isn't anything.
That's right. And what was I going to say about that?
Sorry.
He is, what Barry Neva used to say, taking Peirce's knowledge and shining it in the light, in the face of the other guy. He's not trying to make it make mm-hmm. it relevant to what McLuhan's doing with the Apelian. So he's just shining the light of his specialist knowledge in your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
obvious. And then he says, but I see what you're getting at, and I assume he's answering me, but I see what you're getting at, the tetrad. The problem is that each part of the quadrivium has its own tetrad. 2, √5 + 1. 2, √5 + 1. That's probably some esoteric mathematical subplot of Peirce or something. I don't know what he's saying there, but the problem is that each part of the quadrivium has its own tetrad. Well, every aspect, concept, object has a tetrad, so that doesn't add anything. Don't think I'm trying to get at the tetrad. That could be brought in. So then a little later, he decides to add something else, and he says, phi, fo, and fum meet phi. So phi, phi, fo, fum. So he has phi, fo, fum meet phi. I'm not sure what that is. So he's being silly, and he's not taking on the seriousness of what I presented. So I wanted to get your comment, and I'll enjoy playing it to him. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. I heard a click. I thought there was a hang-up.
So, no.
So we finished Dilworth. We finished Scott. Now we'll go down to page 96.
Let me just ask one question about Dilworth. You say on 83, pulled from a paraphrased summary of March 1973 talk at St. Basil's Seminary. Do you know anything about the meeting or whatever it was in March 1973?
Let me see. So that's page 83.
Bottom of 83. in other words, Dilworth is paraphrasing the talk that McLuhan gave at that meeting or whatever it was at the seminary. And I'm just wondering if you know anything about that meeting or...
Not offhand, I don't think.
No.
Pulled
okay.
from a paraphrase summary. So he...
I thought you might even have been there.
No. But what is this? This is... he's quoting this... The quote I read by him is his summary of some summary that someone made in 1973 of a McLuhan talk.
Well, maybe. It may be that. It may be a, sort of a double paraphrase, like you're saying. Or Dilworth may have made the first paraphrase. And when you say a paraphrase summary, you may be... in the book saying that here comes the paraphrase, right? So we don't quite know if it's a first order or second order paraphrase.
Right. So maybe not right now, but I could look that up and see. I'll look up what's in the book that Dilworth is mm-hmm. essays in, see if they add something to that.
Yeah. If I can find the book, I'll do the same thing.
You may have the book?
Oh, I have it for sure, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I even have it in electronic form, I believe.
Mm. Okay, so on page 96, second quote down, I have said, and I think I read this last 2 weeks ago, I talked about the twist and the simultaneous cultural transparency. I'll just say it. That was happening, but most people were listening to Cliff Richard's pop music, starting to learn the twist. They weren't grasping languages, ancient and modern. McClure was too optimistic about what intelligence would do with its time, its new leisure. Everybody was paranoid of, quote, simultaneous cultural transparency. Yeah, because I've been earlier explaining that management was able to make McClure's predictions look silly because they were a stick in the mud and they held everything back to everybody's destitution, and so McLuhan was sacrificed for a larger sacrifice, because I have here, McLuhan told me, management managed to hold on and stop the opportunities that new technology was giving. They got their Kissinger, just sat there and said, quote, we aren't moving, you don't run nothing, we run it, and we're still going to fight wars based on nationalism or tribalism. McLuhan didn't realize it would get away with that stubbornness for so many decades. Now, we're at an interesting point today where these, quote, elites aren't getting away with anything, are they?
Well, I mean, you could say they aren't getting away with anything, but you could also say they're getting away with everything.
Yeah, there's a great illumination going on, as we said, a great transparency and a great numbness. And so a lot of people are having the transparency experience, and another 50% are having the numbness experience. And they argue over which one's doing one or the other, right?
That's right. Yeah, but I would not put it at 50-50. I would say it's about 95 numb and 5 illumination.
Right. But what's interesting, that people, they both think something's dramatic going on. There's a lot of worry across the board of society.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the tech body, or, quote, the media, is playing this up. And, yes, we're back to the nuclear clock. What is that, the doomsday clock mm-hmm. that the Atomic Bulletin Board has?
Yeah, yeah.
I think we're a couple of seconds from blow-up. So,
mm-hmm.
So what's interesting is what made people – quote, panic. Well, the COVID started, and then what Putin's doing is that. But people were already surprised by Black Lives Matter and the destruction of American cities, and nobody doing anything about it. It's for some reason in late, well, it could be because it was an election year, some practical, efficient causality. People say, look, they were out to get rid of Trump, and they were going to create all kinds of crap in 2020, you know, to get him out.
Well,
have a
just
reason.
The election of Trump was a shock.
That was the shock. Yeah, that's what the shock
COVID
was.
And,
yeah.
Well, but the what's basically since the Second World War, there has just been one shock after another in different fields.
Yes.
And so now it's like the small rocks that were let loose down the slope in 1945. Those have become huge boulders. And nobody knows what to do about them.
Yeah, yeah. And Trump, part of the gall of Trump was he claimed to know what to do about them.
Yeah.
And he fully was not qualified. He had not gone to the proper think tanks. He didn't have any experience in the sober halls of Congress. He just was an amateur. What gall to do what he did. But that's what the shocking part of his image was. He claimed to know more than anybody else. And ran on that point, you know, you could say rudely, crudely. But,
mm-hmm. But he knew how to do all that stuff because he was part of that world.
Yep, in New York.
Part of the TV world and part of the bullshit world and all that sort of stuff.
That's right.
So it's, it's not to be expected that Trump could take some sort of objective view, as if that were possible, of what was going on. He came from the wrong world. He had the wrong advisors. And he had no idea about the levers that had to be deployed.
Yeah, so he did a silly thing. He went on Twitter and now caused an Armageddon because he picked a silly technology to communicate. So he's like Mr. Magoo. He's always making mistakes, but he can still lands on his feet so far.
Yes, well, I think that's right, that he may not have known what he was doing when he went to Twitter. It may have been sort of the last resort because he couldn't do anything with the news and he had been cut off from his old TV world, you could say.
Yeah.
So he goes to Twitter, and by going to Twitter, if I understand you correctly, he was expressing something about the modern world that could never be expressed in terms of a tweet, but that movement to Twitter tells us where we're at.
Yeah, he chose a new medium and used it. So I had a point there. So he having been part of the New York gossip world and the media world, he knew they were all bullshit. He knew they knew nothing. So he says, I, as McLuhan once said, that the other people around him wouldn't even pretend to know what's going on. At least he pretended to know what's going on. Well, Trump pretended to know what's going on. He was McLuhan-esque on that literal level of putting on everybody, knowing that he had no opposition of, He knew he could show that his opposition was melting or what could be melted.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that a commonality between McLuhan and Trump is that they had no problem wearing masks, and what differentiated them from most people is that they knew that they were wearing masks?
Yes, and Trump, in a way, acted as if the medium had no content. He knew just acting the way he did, with no proper qualifications, he couldn't even finish his sentences. It was absurd listening to him. But he knew that would be a way. Now that's creating a gap. This would allow people to participate in his image by not being a verbal know-it-all, because he couldn't finish his sentence, but he put on that he knew it all. He non-verbally communicated that with a kind of swagger.
Yeah. Well, that was the whole notion of his TV show, I forget what it was called, but the whole notion of him firing people and stuff was that, he could see into their soul. He could see the future, all this sort of stuff. And that gave him this godlike power to hire and dismiss. And so he knew from that TV experience that the content was bullshit.
Yeah.
Right? He had been, that's what he had been purveying and had gained popularity by selling bullshit. And so then he applies that to politics, and maybe he surprises even himself, because it turns out that bullshit, not only in television, but in politics, was exactly what people wanted.
Yes, by someone who appeared to know it was bullshit and called everybody out first. It's a matter of who calls who out first, right? So he jumped the gun. You go into debates, and he used the slanging medieval thing of nicknaming people, right?
Yep.
That was
yep.
a good strategy. Yep. So I'm just looking up. No wonder I'm writing about him. Looking up the TV show. Come on, when is it? I keep wanting to say The Argument, but that's, it begins with A, maybe. What was the word? Still scrolling. It's quite a long Wikipedia entry. Come on, where's the TV shows? Boy, there's a lot here. I'll just put in the word television, see if that brings it up. See, we're so out of it, we don't even know the show title. That's how little we engage. Yeah, it begins with A, The Apprentice.
Oh, The Apprentice, that's right. That's now, right. I never actually watched one of the shows.
Me either. I don't know what I heard he fired people, but I don't know what it is. But it sounds like people are auditioning to work for him. So he's the apprentice when he gets to the White House. Everybody wants
That's
to
right.
call him an apprentice. He fulfilled
right.
his own, whatever
I
you
am.
Call that.
I hired myself.
And then from that point on, everybody else became Trump and tried to fire him for 4 years.
That's right. Good point. That's the flip of figure and ground.
Yeah, he did it. Okay, so how does this quote from Cliché to Archetype, 1970 book, McLuhan and Wilford Watson, page 150. A cliché is an act of consciousness. Total consciousness is the sum of all the clichés of all the media or technologies we probe with. I was always impressed with that when I first read that.
Yeah, and that's what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Right?
The total of the media.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. So everything can be a cliche, everything can be an archetype, and consciousness is all of the cliches and archetypes in all of their relations.
And the guts you have to engage them all. How many of cliches can you put on with archetypal intensity?
Correct. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. And archetypal intensity might be called tactility.
Yes, yeah. Or the larger mind. A cliche is an act of consciousness. You know, it's an act of consciousness. Total consciousness is the sum of all the cliches of all the media or technologies we probe with. That's where I came up with the idea of mythic stage in my previous talk about politics. The mythic stage is the particular media or cliches you use. So your identity is made up of the media you use or celebrate or defend, and it's mythic. In McLuhan's meaning of mythic, it includes all that you're working with. Not myth as a literary true or false statement. He defined myth as a total structure that summarized a very complex process.
Correct.
So you have the Arabs are defending their mythic stage of manuscript culture, I'll call it, against the industrial or electronic culture of America, represented by McDonald's burgers and other American things that appear to be satanic to the Arabs. It's such a contrasting mythic stage that the American carries into the meeting. Compared to the smaller.
The same, exactly that dialectic is playing itself out in the United States and, in fact, always has.
Yeah.
Right? There's always been this tension between people that are trying to maintain a tradition. Sometimes that means status quo. Sometimes it means an appeal to the Bible or something.
Yeah.
And then other people who say, that's not important. Let's attend to these new things.
Yeah.
And so that dialectic or contest or quarrel between the ancient and the modern is always going on, and always going on everywhere.
Right, and you're an ancient, you have a certain mythic structure, and or if you're a modern, you have a certain mythic structure, way
right.
more than used to be 1,000 years ago. It was still different, quote, lifestyles, different media, but they had a apparently, according to our written history, they had a simpler, less complicated media choice to make up their mythic stage. And I call it a myth, but it's a stage, because McLuhan said at one point that the stage of the global theater is the credit card. You know, it's not some theatrical structure. The credit card is your stage. So the credit card, he said, gave you access to things for prestige. I think he called mm-hmm. it prestige for use. That's in a tetrad on the credit card in Laws of Media, mm-hmm. I think. So a mythic stage. So people are putting yeah. on different stages, older media that they think they can stand on, in a context where there is no ground or no ultimate stage. Or the argument is over whose stage is going to be named to be the stage, the ultimate stage.
Correct.
So when I think of Innes, he said the American dilemma began with the battle between the fur trade and the farmers. You remember that
yeah.
in Innes?
Yeah, of course, sure.
Yeah.
And McLuhan thought that was very important.
Yeah, that the Civil War was between two technological mixtures, the
mm-hmm.
fur trade and all
mm-hmm.
that brought with it, versus the guys who wanted to start plantations or agriculture,
right.
Stay home.
But if we go back to the quote from Cliché and Archetype, page 150, the first phrase in that encapsulates everything we've been talking about.
Yeah.
He says a cliche is an act of consciousness. And one of the things that I think is very important for any sort of good reading is to always try out subjective and objective genitives wherever there's a phrase like act of consciousness. So if we say, if we look at that as a subjective genitive, as to say that the cliche is an act that belongs to a certain consciousness, then what we see is that the presentation of any language, the presentation of any mask, the presentation of any position is always limited. Right? You were calling this one myth.
Yeah.
Right? The human beings never get beyond the presentation of a certain myth. And the question that is posed by somebody who thinks, like McLuhan, is there such a thing as total consciousness that does not leap to the absurd claim that it is not mythic, that it is not some sort of mask, not some sort of stage, but is it possible that total consciousness is itself a stage? Is itself an example of making? Is itself limited? And so once you ask those sorts of questions, that in the quotation that you offer there, the word total in total consciousness and the word sum, the sum of all cliches, those words become very complicated. And the sentence can't be understood without trying to see, well, what could McLuhan mean by total here and sum? Does he mean that we could just leap away from our credit card, from our stage, from our myth? No, of course not. So if, in that case, what the hell did he mean?
Yes. So at this point, you mentioned subjective genitive objective gender. You use these terms every now and then, and when I first was reading you, I didn't know what they were. I'd forgotten in my grammar knowledge, so I looked them up, and I never can remember. But is an objective genitive or subjective the word of? What could you define for us, for the record, the two phrases refer to?
Right. So the phrase is act of consciousness.
Yeah.
And the subjective genitive is the reading that to mean that the act belongs to consciousness, right? It's like saying the ball of the boy.
Yeah.
The ball belongs to the boy. So the act of consciousness as a subjective genitive is that the consciousness, you could say, is ground and the act is figure.
Yes.
So, okay. So then the objective genitive is that the act is ground and the consciousness is figure. So here, instead of the act of consciousness indicating that consciousness owns the act, here the consciousness is the object of the act. And so in a certain sense, it is consciousness that belongs to the act. It's a reversal.
Yeah.
So when thinking is going on, it's continually looking at genitives and seeing how they work in reverse. And McLuhan talked about this constantly in terms of the ground becoming figure and the figure becoming ground.
Yeah, now, how did you come up with those terms? Did McLuhan ever use those terms?
No, I don't think so. But they're fairly common in scholastic theology, and Heidegger very frequently will say that some genitive can't be understood. He'll say it can't be understood objectively, it needs to be understood subjectively.
Right, so in your studies of Heidegger is where you came across it first, and then you applied it to McLuhan.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah, so so you have the objective and subjective. So of means that the act owns consciousness, goes in the direction.
Well, that would be the objective. That would be the objective, right? The act of consciousness would say that consciousness is the result of the act.
Right. And then you have the act possessed by consciousness?
Correct.
And that's subjective.
Correct.
So
and so there's a dynamic there, right? And the dynamic can be named, the medium is the message.
Yeah. So
the of is the relationship.
Yeah, so what kind of, if our act is generates a consciousness.
Yeah.
And then the act is part of consciousness. One's a container and one is a process.
Yeah, you could say that. But I prefer just the idea of which belongs to the other, which is ground and which is figure.
Yeah. And they always flip or can be flipped.
Absolutely. That's what the medium is the message means.
Yeah.
Is that the medium is a message is the medium is inherently dynamic. And in order to understand poles of any relationship, you have to understand how the dynamic of the relationship works.
Right. So then I try to talk about it below more informally, and I say McLuhan juxtaposing comprehensive ideas with the dull word cliché. This was 1966. That's approximately when he was doing cliche archetype. He was doing it throughout the whole 60s with Watson, you see in the letters. I mean, they started the book in like 62 or so.
At least started their dialogue then.
Yeah. McLuhan juxtaposing comprehensive ideas with the dull word cliche. This was 1966. This was the last pinnacle of abundance. It's going to get cruel in 68. That's because live Sputnik news broadcast using the satellite proscenium arch. It's going to get cruel in 68 with Vietnam coming in, the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy after the summer of love in 67. In the mid-60s, there's an optimistic feeling about North America. Do I mean about North America or about, like, all over? I think it's about the lifestyle of North America, the abundance, making everybody feel pretty good. In the mid-60s, or numbed to the point of carefree, in the mid-60s, there's not, like, I always remember when Carol and I went out in Seattle in 69, we were able, as Canadians, to walk into the welfare office and get food stamps. I don't know how, I don't remember how we did it, what we filled out, but there was no checking who we were. That's what I'm thinking of when the optimistic feeling of ongoing abundance, that people were basically giving things away. It didn't matter. There was a generosity on the propagandic use of money. Money, as an obsolete medium, was going to be everywhere, and it was very easy to get it, and Biden seems to be trying to bring that back by handing out money all over the place. Okay, so in
I can remember going to a Renaissance fair around that time in, I think it was near San Francisco, somewhere in Northern California. And the feeling there was exactly what you're describing.
Yeah.
You know, it was a summer of love, as you say, and it was nothing could be better than this, was the general feeling.
Yeah, and everybody was giving everything away for free. The diggers were giving away free food.
That's right.
Okay, Tiki McLuhan, there was an abundance of chemical body operations, but nobody saw the disservice of the TV and chip body coming. That's what was not foreseen, that this was a celebration of the old chemical body in all its activities without friction. Now it could flow easily into any activity.
Yeah.
Because it was not the ground. It was not doing any job. It wasn't holding things together as a ground. It was let loose. It is remarkable how short it lasted, you know. It didn't last very long, unless you consider the period from Elvis to 67 and the Beatles as a slow awareness of abundance as they got out of the hardship of the Korean War and World War II. So, yeah, you could say it was a slow unfolding of the emotion of multitude. And, of course, McLuhan, that feeling is what McLuhan was surfing. And many people, critics, would say he was optimistic. No, he was explaining where the optimism feeling came from in everybody else. And he was subtly saying, look out, watch out, this is going to flip. You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. Well, he had been saying that for 15 years or more at that time. Well, but he had never been understood. The only time people ever listened to him is when they started misinterpreting him as a messianic yay-sayer or something.
Yeah, the Newsweek special is March 67. That's why I guess the difference, he's already been saying this, but now he had a world stage or a world audience, a captive audience that was attached to him by Gossage and other people who saw that he was the next flavor to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to ride it pretty good. I like that footage in Telescope, the Telescope special on him, where he's in a disco, and the go-go girls are dancing behind him, and he's saying, can somebody turn that down? and then he says, this music is not music. It is like foam rubber that you press up against, which evokes the falsies girls wore, right? The padded bras. But it was very poetic what he was doing there, talking about this movie, this music presses up against you. Why am I citing that?
The phrase, can you turn it down, has so many meanings.
Yes. He means that philosophically to everybody. Yeah, can we turn this global mania down? So yeah. I think I wanted to point out that's his acting. That's where he was actually a very interesting actor in the Global Theater. He was putting on people. He knew the effects and what he was saying.
Well, do you think he knew? I don't know that he knew the effects as if he had a godlike vision.
No, he had the vision. He didn't know he'd be that successful.
Well, that successful / unsuccessful.
Yes, right? That's
it
right.
It turned out that that act, which was, one probe, turned out not to work. And so by 1970, as you've pointed out many times, he had decided to pull back from it.
Yes, and he admitted it in Take Today. He has a section on success as failure and failure as success.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
and notice how we're going round and round and round the same point, but not because we can't get anywhere, but because the point is so important.
And yeah, that's what he called depth perception. You spiral around in depth.
Yeah,
it's
resonating. Yeah.
And that's, it's not repetition. Literate repetition. It's not that. It's resonance. And, when I think of the debate between McLuhan and Norman Mailer in 67 or late 66, Mailer has a fit. He gets morally outraged. And McLuhan has this detachment. That's what he's cool through all of this. He may have to deal with new issues, new problems every day because the success of his image for a year or so was just blowing up all over the place. I thought he kept pretty cool, unless what was sneaking up on him was his brain disease, that he had to have the biggest surgery, which some people who like to not like McLuhan in the end, they'll tolerate me talking about him, but they're going to dismiss him. I'm thinking of this one person said, holy geez, you're telling me he had brain surgery, the longest of humans? Yes, longest known in history. And they go, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, he deserved it. That guy was wrong. He was operating on a diseased brain.
Yeah.
That came out. But I think that he, despite the, I was going to bring this up, the Doctor Strange salute, Doctor Strangelove, that salute in the movie, I think I was talking about this with someone else, is the salute that McLuhan gave when he apparently blacked out in front of the students, when the pressure was being done on his brain. He made a Nazi salute in class. It would scare the crap out of the kids, and they just sort of sit there stunned.
Are you saying that this happened once or this happened repeatedly?
Oh, repeatedly. In class.
Well, I know the blackouts happened repeatedly.
But he didn't know the arm.
No. And so when he had the blackout, it would cause some sort of constriction of his arm and it would get lifted up. Is that the idea?
Something like that.
Huh.
And, there are a lot of little details like that in Marchand's book. He was good at finding little, I don't know how he talked to people who were there.
I like Marchand's book.
Yeah.
I think it's in many ways, it's a good presentation. I think he had good insight into the relationship of McLuhan and his mother. He doesn't go to extremes with McLuhan at all. If McLuhan is getting too rambunctious, Marchand takes him down.
Yeah.
If he's too down, Marchand takes him up. So, yeah,
that's right.
It's a good book in that respect.
Yeah, and he got to talk to a lot of people who told him anecdotes, and he put it in there. And it was probably very important that he was not policed by the family, that he could do
right. But that's what got him into trouble, right?
I heard they eventually came around. I don't know. What trouble do you know of that he got into?
Because he talks in the book about problems between Marshall and Eric. And between Marshall and the girls.
Yeah.
And the family reacted against that, and that's why they wanted Terry Gordon to do the new bio.
Right. Yeah, they did ignore him as much as possible.
Ostracized.
I mean, he wasn't involved with them anyways. He surprised them all. but they didn't embrace them for years until they they had to give up.
Well, I think they started off by, they gave them a bunch of permissions, which they then came to regret.
How would you know that? Who did you talk to that would tell you that?
No, that's not from talking to anybody. That's just from, in order to get access to the papers in Ottawa, which is really the basis of everything, he had to get their permission, and he thanks them in his book for giving him that.
No. You know what he did? He got a job. He's the one who organized the archives. And as he did it, he took notes. That's how he wrote the biography. He had the job. Like, he had access more than the McLuhans did. Because once the archives had it, they wanted to organize it, and he had the job. I don't know if he was the only one who did it, but he told me. He had the job of organizing the archives, and he made a brilliant opportunistic move. I can take this information that I'm sifting and organizing it, take notes, and make a book out of it. And that's what he did.
Right. Yeah, but in order to have that job and in order to do the book, he needed their permission.
I don't know about that. You might be right, but I don't know. It never... I think that they had no clue that he was coming around the bend, and he didn't let anybody know. I mean, he didn't have to tell anybody he was doing it. He just said, oh, you want me to organize these things? Dobbs started it. Remember, I started it in November, December 1980. I organized not the letters, but the rest of it, which was in a mess, and then he got paid for it in Ottawa four years later, say.
But you're saying you suspect that he got this job and got this access, but without the McLuhans knowing it?
Yeah, because I don't see them caring. Once they sold the thing and they got their money, that was it. They didn't care what the archives did with it. They put down rules eventually at some point. You know, there's a whole section that you can't see. Clinton's the first to get permission to see the 40 stuff. From Michael, but I don't see them caring what the employees did or the procedure the archives did in organizing an archive.
All right,
that would be part of their knowledge. The profession would know what to do about that.
Well, we can. That's something we can look up. It's not a hugely important point.
Yeah. We should ask Phil some point. Call him up or something. I should ask him about that. Maybe I got it wrong. But he did. I did talk to him about it. I wouldn't know otherwise. He told me that he worked there.
No, that's for sure. He actually...
You blipped out. Uh-oh. Did I blip out? Okay, I'm going to hang up and call him back. I think something happened to his phone. Okay. Are you there? On. So you're there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I think it I don't know if you know about the technology, but I think it carries on because I didn't hang it up.
Yeah, this I do remember that in one of our earlier conversations, something like this happened, and then it turned out that it wasn't recording.
Yeah, but that was, we didn't know that it
That's
stopped.
Right.
We know this
yeah.
time, so we may have corrected it. I think if it stopped, no, see, it wouldn't stop. You got three phones on there, and if one drops off, I dropped off. They don't know that you dropped off. I dropped off. I can come back on because the other two are still functioning. And I will go over there and see if it's talking. Say something.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello,
it's still,
Bob. Calling Hawaii.
It's going.
Yeah.
So
okay, good.
All right. So we'll finish the Marshawn topic. That gets us into... I think McLuhan would say tiger traps and elephant cages. You know, we get in trouble there. So we are talking about page 96, cliches as act of consciousness. So what I was saying, let me see, I was reading.
See, one way to look at a cliche as an act of consciousness. Let's go back to what you were saying about stage, right? So you say if a cliche is a stage of consciousness. So does that mean that consciousness always belongs to stage, so that it's always a certain role? Or does it mean that stage always belongs to consciousness, so that what consciousness is the sum total of stages? Well, both of those are involved in the phrase.
Yeah, now that's your interplay of objective and subjective genitive?
Correct. Or between figure and ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, don't ask me to answer that, right? That would take volumes.
No. I'm just trying to relate what we're saying here to what we were talking about earlier. You were talking about stage, the credit card is a stage. Yeah, you were talking about...
the feeling of 67, feeling of abundance.
Yeah.
And it is interesting that 68 is the year the news industry says they now had satellite access and they could broadcast satellite footage or something on the people's TV. So there was a deeper involvement in the global theater in 68, and that was a flip out of the chemical body. He says England had reached a point, in his dialogue with John Lennon, he says England, Britain had arrived at a phase of contentment in the 50s, and they got there maybe before America did. So there was a contentment in 65, 66, 67 that then flipped, just like it flipped in Britain by the early 70s. You started to have social unrest. The contentment wasn't there anymore. So the flip from the feeling of 67 to 68, which is traditionally said is a very violent year, right, with two assassinations and riots in Detroit, Chicago and all this stuff, it was a different mood in 68. Matter of fact, those that want to say, tend to be conservatives, that the 60s was a bad time, they'll go into the events of 68. Those that were part or enjoyed the mood of 66, 67 will go into the events of the year before, 67, before the violence of 68. So the divide iconically is left-right is between 67 and 68. And what one remembers, what one chooses to remember.
Yeah. And the problems in France, the French intellectuals divided on the question of 68, right?
Yes, that was a big deal. So those are the stages. 67, 68 are two stages.
In the sense that we were talking about before.
Yeah.
If people understood that only in terms of chronological time, they would miss the fact that stages are missed. They are perpetual possibilities.
Yeah, they're not limited to time. the clock tower.
Correct. That's right.
It just struck me, a major good-feeling event, symbolic of 67, is Expo 67 in Montreal. And
yep.
It's timely. It's like an artist has good timing. McLuhan, thanks to Don Thiel, is celebrated all through Expo 67. He becomes a myth, a subplot in the exhibitions that people saw. That's pretty good timing by McLuhan as, quote, an artist, an actor of the Global Theater, to position himself, accidentally probably, but end up looking like he positioned himself to appear in the pinnacle of good feeling, which Expo 67 was for many
right.
people around the world.
So in that, McLuhan in 66, let's say,
yeah.
had suddenly sort of blossomed onto the world. And for Canadians, this was a way of saying Canadian intellectuals are world class.
Yeah, they've arrived.
And
Canada has arrived.
Expo 67 says Canadian design, Canadian, being Canadian is world class.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so these events, McLuhan and the Expo, merged into Canada's ideal presentation of itself.
Right. Don Thiel writes a good essay on that, on Expo, showing the programming of the environment under satellite conditions that McLuhan wrote about. The new art was the programming the planet. That was a major meme theme or something in Expo, was the programming of the global environment. So the art forms, McLuhan's idea and the fact of the acting out of it, emerged together, and the best of the 50-60s period, what is the artist of that? The artist in the sense of a celebration of what was going on? McLuhan was the right guy because he was celebrating what was happening as well as providing a warning, but he's the guy who had perfect pitch at that period. The world didn't know that. We, in retrospect, can see that he had it. Some parts of the world felt it because they made him famous. They just said, this guy is saying something significant no one else is doing. So it is quite an amazing expression of the logos that McLuhan was riding a surf wave, and the logos recognized this and then also made Expo have a good vibe. And then that affected the French intellectuals who, because they were interested in what was going on in their cousins in Quebec, they started to look at McLuhan because he was the guy translating Joyce. No, that was explaining Joyce, as these guys in France started to get access to Joyce in the first French translations. And so that leads to Baudrillard, Derrida, Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, Barthes, the whole gang of them spill out. But they are reacting to the bad news of 68, the failed revolution of May 68.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would just add that I haven't read Thiel's essay, but it would be limiting to understand McLuhan seeing the planet as an art form as only a celebration.
No, yeah, right? No. I'm emphasizing half the story.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm saying that the good vibe of 67, because McLuhan himself is representing the flip into 68 because he needs brain surgery. He's got a problem. Mm-hmm. And Don, who had left Toronto and was working in McGill in 66, 67, he met Marshall in the parties leading into the beginning of Expo, let's say in the spring of 67. And, you know, he was an old friend. He knew Marshall well, and he said, there's something wrong with Marshall. He told me he saw that Marshall, in his actions as a person, you know, his vibe, there was something ill. He saw that in the spring 67, and they all discovered it by November 67. Gerd Stern was part of the process of at a party. He told me this. He was at a party in New York because he was hanging out with Carpenter at the Fordham thing and the Fordham scene. And somebody told Gerd about the blackouts. And Gerd thought, that's odd. So he goes over and talks to a doctor that he knew there at the party. And the doctor says, that's serious. Who are you talking about? So Gerd took the guy over and introduced him to McLuhan and maybe Corinne. And they talked about this problem he had with the Dr. Strangelove salute and the blackouts. And the doctor said, man, you need to get in the hospital right away. So he had to make a decision over the next day or so, and Corinne won out. Corinne says, no, you're going in the hospital. So he goes in there, and he objects to all this. He doesn't like doctors, and, according to Marchand's book. And he puts up with it, and then he has the longest unconsciousness of any surgery up to that point known in history.
Didn't he go in under duress and then actually checked himself out and then had to be brought back in?
I think so. Yeah, there was some real resistance by him.
Yeah. And do you know anything about how they found the tumor? Because in those days, they didn't have an MRI or CAT scan or anything.
No, they dug in there. They dug in and looked at it.
Uh-huh.
And brought it out, and it was a benign tumor.
Yeah. But the size of a tennis ball or something.
Yeah. And he said the convalescence was the real agony, and that they didn't know to apply anesthetics to the convalescence. He writes about that in War and Peace.
Right.
He also couldn't remember the whole previous year. And he lost a lot of his reading and brain information processing for a year or two just before that. And then he was super sensitive to sounds from that point on.
Yeah. He became very fidgety. And that's one of the ties between McLuhan and Jordan Peterson.
Oh, that's right.
Both
Peterson got ill, didn't he?
That's right.
Wow.
And ended up extremely fidgety and nervous about sound. And all of this is a commonality, aside from all of the other commonalities.
That's incredible. So, you mean it's come out since he got sick a year or two ago that he's still on, pins and needles?
Well, that was, according to his daughter, that was one of the major symptoms of his problems.
Oh,
is that he could not stay still.
Mm.
I forget there's a technical name for this condition, but in my blog, I've quoted descriptions of Peterson and then juxtaposed them with descriptions of McLuhan. And they're quite close.
So you've already pointed that we've discussed it, but you have applied it and wrote it out, the parallels going on.
Yes. Well, I had done this even before we discussed it.
Okay. So 67 to 2017 is 50 years precisely, right? Half a century. Because it's about 2017 when he started to get attention, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So isn't it amazing? That's where I look at it as the Logos has its own communication order in the brain chart in Laws of Media, the characteristics of left hemisphere and right hemisphere. There's a term for the left side, I think it's called abstract patterns, where it's a different phrase in the right hemisphere, a different kind of pattern recognition. If you had the book there, you could just quickly look it up and see that the way abstract is used. One by means of two. There's two meanings. Do you have that right there?
No, I don't have it, but it's exactly what we've been talking about in our whole conversation. The medium is the message because it's dynamic and not singular. Because the medium is the message is dynamic, then any word like abstract, for example, or like pattern is inherently going to have a whole series of meanings, not only a series of meanings as figures, but a series of meanings as grounds.
Both. Yeah, and that's Hendiades is one aspect of that, one by means
that's
of
right.
two.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're talking about 67 and the feeling of abundance that you got at the Renaissance Fair and I got in the welfare office in Seattle. But I think it's interesting to flip from 67 to 68. And then there's election in late 68, and then everybody is sobered up that, you could say Trump got elected, the bad guy got elected, Mafia Nixon.
And they got him, too.
Yeah, then they even he has to go. See, because it's getting beyond good and evil, getting Nietzschean. There's programming of the planet and the White House on a whole other level beyond normal chemical body value systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, they maybe it's going to turn out that this is a big part of your pamphlet. But what we can see with both Nixon and Trump is the huge power of media, media in the figurative sense. And perhaps with Nixon, you see its triumph, and with Trump, you see its demise.
Yeah. Yeah, it's gone beyond the theater of Nixon era, and then it's excessively obsolete and supernovaed with Trump. Mm-hmm. And that means that finally it's moved into another area, which becomes a figure. Is that figure the zombie Biden?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. It's you can see Biden as the quixotic knight.
Yeah.
Of knight with a K of the departing power of media.
Yes.
And in fact, it also relates to Vietnam and stuff in the way that you were hinting at a minute ago, and that is that with satellite communication in 1968, you had sort of the ascendancy of media into a godlike status, into a world-straddling power.
Yes, and then you had the Tet Offensive in early 68 Vietnam.
Yeah, which,
everything went bad in 68. It was a general myth. Now, there's this Professor Betts, B-E-T-T-S, and there's a book called Counterblasting Canada, which is a bunch of essays on McLuhan, a recent book. And Betts does one on Sheila Watson and Wilfred and McLuhan discussing anti-environment, I guess. And they decide, or McLuhan says, that Canada is the anti-environment to America and mm-hmm. to the global theater. Therefore, it is the best artist of the late 60s. Canada, not Frank Zappa, not Bob Dylan, not some theater guy, or, you know, whatever art, Gutenberg art you want to quote. Those guys aren't artists compared to the real art, which is the environment, the mythic stages. And Canada as a mythic stage is the appropriate counter-environment to America as a world environment with perfect pitch. And that is what comes together in 67 at Expo. Canada is the triumphant Oscar winner for great performance, and McLuhan is mm-hmm. in the middle of that, and he's the one talking about the great artist is not a human, a chemical body, it's an environment, and it's Canada as an anti-environment.
Yeah. Yep, yep.
And then you have the celebration of that as Trudeau becomes prime minister.
Correct.
So that actually was a good feeling in 68 for a big part of Canada.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So then you can see the intervening 50 years as the small hole in the bubble leaking more and more air. Until,
yeah, as the celebrity becomes dope addicted and you know, kills a few people by accident, you know, Johnny Depp syndrome takes over. The Depp state, not the deep
That's
state,
right.
The Depp state.
Yep.
So, yeah, every celebrity, as McLuhan said, he wouldn't worship, he wouldn't advocate, he said, Queen for a day on a dog. So he's criticizing the fame neurosis of Hollywood and all that from the 30s and 40s on. And he's trying to be detached from it. But overall, are there any celebrities that don't suffer? Increasingly, from the 70s, 80s, 90s, they all have a bad time at some point. It's not cool to be hogging the content of the Android meme in that phase, and then later the tech body.
Mm-hmm.
The tech body is the technology coming alive and becoming famous and hijacking the process, including directing it. If you look at my tiny note chart, I've got producer, director, lawyer, detective, and actor or something else in there. I've got all these roles that the Android meme is miming, and then the tech body acts out. tech body is acting out what we, our eyes and ears and senses, are perceiving. We're totally possessed by the tech body now. So everything we're looking at, experiencing in what they call the news or the media, is a completely programmed environment. Not fake, programmed consciously by the tech body. And we'll always be creating interruptions and changes in the direction of what people think is unfolding. So the tech body is the new art form today.
I can follow what you're saying, but what the thing that I don't quite get is if you say that the tech body has programmed perceptions, programmed all of the sensory ratios, then it seems that the tech body is both cause and effect.
Yes.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, that would be page 137 at the bottom of Take Today. Remember, process pattern recognition via percepts as opposed to causes becoming effects via concepts. Remember we went over that quote?
Yes.
That's what Barry's getting at, this complexity. And there's another point. What did you say? It's not juggling senses. It's juggling bodies. That's where I go past McLuhan or overlay McLuhan with a more up-to-date statement of what's juggled. The senses is just the chemical body, but you've got the digital senses and televised senses. Barry called it, we have 14 senses now, so we've added to the five senses.
But it would be a mistake, Bob, to think that McLuhan took the senses literally.
No, that's right. I mean, he called them wit.
Yeah, so for example, when he says that TV is tactile,
yeah,
or when he says that symphonic music is visual, right? It's obvious that, or when he portrays the television as an ear, he saw literal interpretation as belonging to the Gutenberg era.
Yeah, he saw the synesthesia.
Well, synesthesia is a certain resolution of the senses, and there's one resolution that's typical of Gutenberg, and then there are other resolutions that Gutenberg tried not to see, that it repressed.
Yeah.
So it's not the case that McLuhan saw the senses as literal, and therefore you can't say that he didn't see them as bodies. Bodies is one interpretation that McLuhan would have been very happy to admit once he was sure that no literalism was meant.
Right.
Because bodies aren't themselves aren't literal.
Yeah, so I'm critiquing the audience of McLuhan that takes McLuhan literally and thinks in literal senses.
Okay, correct. I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I do that by suggesting bodies, which I know people are going to think differently, if they can even conceive of it. So that's a way of breaking the programmed response to McLuhan by the uninformed perceiver.
Sure.
The unsophisticated perceiver. Yeah, no.
And there's a whole tradition of this in Christianity, and there may well be in other cultures as well. But when in Christianity there's talk of the mystical body, or in the communion, this is the body of Christ, the whole notion of body is complicated. And so what you have in modern times is a kind of a forgetting of that complication, an overlaying of that complication for something that's more simple. And that simplicity allows for efficiency, you could say, but it also allows for blindness. And so simplicity allows for efficiency.
Yeah.
Once you simplify a process, then it's possible to maximize it. But in the maximization, you also maximize the blindness that was a part of the simplification that first allowed the efficiency.
Right.
And so there, that's where we're at in the history of the world, is that we have simplified things to enable the greatest possible efficiency, but that's tied to the greatest possible blindness.
Yep, important point that we've repeated all the way through the 48 episodes.
Correct. <done. laughs> Apologies.
What'd you say?
Apologies.
Yeah. The Thiel talks about the art of Paul Klee, and similar to James Joyce, is that they take the unit and they repeat it, Klee in his painting, but it's subtly changed slightly. So that's the going over the same point in what McLuhan called drilling. You're not repeating, you're going into the resonances of and nuances and overlayings and echoes of meaning, to the point McLuhan says you can take two words and make a whole world from it. And he says that's what Joyce did with Finnegan's Wake. He took two words and made a whole world. That's what one...
So notice how that is... getting into points that we've made earlier in our talk. So you can take a certain image, let's say the bird image in Klee, Paul Klee. So over and over and over again in his paintings, he has birds, but sometimes they're upside down, sometimes they're sideways, sometimes they're taken apart. So then you can say, okay, if you take an image like that and drill into it, is the image the figure and we're doing the drilling, or is the image the ground and we are being drilled? So one of McLuhan's methods that we need to emphasize, and that it's not used enough, one of his methods is to take a certain image and to just keep hammering away at it, where we're not, it's not us doing the probing and the hammering. It's us being probed and hammered.
Right. Now, that's the essence of tactility. That's the
Correct.
Definition of it,
Absolutely.
This interplay.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to see that if you start having books, it makes the interplay not so obvious. It forces you, just by the act of reading, to look at one side, one sense, the eyeball sense, and that specializes you, and that starts to create the loss of comprehensiveness, which we
Correct.
Lost 500 years ago, and here we are not knowing how to get to
Extricate
another platform
ourselves.
Of community knowing. Mm-hmm. McLuhan demanded a corporate clairvoyance. He said,
yes.
We all have to recognize this problem that we're in.
Correct.
And
the, one of the really important things about McLuhan is to understand what's meant by clairvoyance. It's not some sort of breakthrough into total illumination. It's the ability of the community to interrogate itself in a transparent manner.
Yeah, aware of the paradoxes that we've been talking about, the complementarity and the hendiadies, while engaging. Now, I have a suspicion the population is doing that and been doing it for 20, 30 years. That's why McLuhan said we're in a state of collective consciousness. But it doesn't have a way to listen to someone explain that to them, that to call the population is getting dumbed down is only half the story. The population is getting smarter and smarter. And you see it in the polls, and you see less and less people participate in the elections as a collective preference of the election.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the amazing thing is that, well, I brought that up earlier. 50% see it, and the other 50 don't. But nobody can figure out how to rally around a proper definition of this situation or a proper wording.
Correct.
That doesn't stop awareness of the problem or the solution. So very strange. And some people might think that this will be resolved accidentally by humans.
Mm-hmm.
Others say, okay, if it's going to be resolved, it's going to be a lot of loss of life on the way there. So you'll find humans are both pessimists and optimists. They don't totally believe it's over. They know, they feel there's, well, we gotta, we've done it, we're still here, so we can get through this one. But maybe this is the most intense expression of the dilemma all through, quote, history.
Sure, because of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And
you could say plagues, not just nuclear weapons. You know, CDC, some germ gets released. Driving around with JW in Atlanta, we drove by the CDC, and he said, Bob, there's stuff in there, and wipe out the planet in 3 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, it's healthy to point out that the equivalent of nuclear bombs have been let loose in history before. So the Black Plague, for example, but also asteroids crashing into the Earth and causing mass extinctions and stuff.
Yeah, I think of Pompeii, the volcano.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, or the fall of Constantinople in 1453, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So the disasters are recurrent. And this quest that you were just talking about for the collectivity to be able to articulate what the stakes are, and to build that articulation into itself, that's almost the story of history.
It's the lessons it's not, we never learned?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's not as if learning becomes extinguished. It's minds, McLuhan is an example of this, minds, when they think properly, come upon the same problems.
Yeah,
and the calling of thinking is to once again take up these problems and drill at them, as you were just saying.
Yeah, so, I've noticed that the if one studies McLuhan, you will get certain stages of questions. The clearer it becomes to you what he's doing, and you'll find other people will come to those same points, too. And if you've done it before them, you can tell them they're going to realize that point. There is a programmed stages of apprehension, I call it my chart, that you go through in encountering, you know, Joyce, Fittings Wake, or McLuhan. You will think certain ideas. At some point, these questions will arise that arose in McLuhan. So you're replaying the stage of apprehension there.
Yeah, that all, I mean, stages of apprehension that already occurred to Plato, let's say.
Yeah.
Or that arguably were known to the Egyptians as far before Plato as we are after.
Right. So, there's a new classroom, a Monday night seminar that Andrew has put up. You know, that series he's presenting.
I know, yeah. I haven't been listening to them.
Yeah, so I listened to the latest. Mm-hmm. And McLuhan was talking about visual space is static, and it doesn't change. And mm-hmm. then he mentioned the word archetype, and he might have said, the archetype doesn't change. And I got an aha there. Oh, that's right. In Plato, the cliche that I heard when I first heard about Plato is, there's a world of archetypes that's more pure than here, and it doesn't change because they're pure.
Mm-hmm.
That's the static space of visuality, of the visual extension. It doesn't change. That's why Plato, who discovered visual space, accidentally under phonetic alphabet conditions, he defined a visual space as archetype that didn't change. They were ideal. That was his distorted or perverse interpretation of the visual effect.
Well, it wasn't perverse because he was very well aware of his limitations. So, I mean, Plato is already a very great thinker because he doesn't define visual space and say that's all there is. He defines visual space and says that's not all there is.
Right. But he says it's ideal. However, he talked about the archetypes being pure. we are a shadow of it, of the ideal archetypes. So
yeah, but it's
yeah, but I'm saying that's the cliche version.
We don't want to get into a long discussion about Plato. I don't think.
I'm saying that that's the cliche response, that they're ideal.
Oh, okay,
but
right. Okay.
When McLuhan explained that the archetype was like visual space and static, then I understood the ideality of the archetype in a new way.
Okay.
I saw that Plato was calling visual space archetype, meaning it didn't change. It was in an ideal condition. Now, ideal meaning it's pretty perfect, so therefore it won't change.
Right.
And that
right.
is what McLuhan's saying visual space as an effect is. It creates a static, uniform, continuous,
okay.
dead space, so to speak.
Right. All right. So let's just stop at this point and try to say what's going on there. All right? So
yeah.
Is McLuhan saying this is what a visual space is, and that's all there is? No, he's not saying that. He's saying something like, in its ideality, this is how visual space takes itself. But visual space is not by itself. It takes itself, but it's not by itself.
Yeah.
It's by acoustic space. And the dynamic between visual space and acoustic space, which is tactility, is where the action is.
Right.
So when he's talking about the archetypes and being static and all that sort of stuff, he's talking about how visual space takes itself. Now, if we go to Plato, when talking about the ideality of the forms and their eternality and their being static, that's how that world takes itself. Plato called that the world of the gods. But the world of the gods was in competition with the world of the Titans, with the underworldly gods.
Yeah.
And that contest, says Plato, is eternal, the contest between them. Right? So
yep.
it's very important always to understand if something is being talked about as it takes itself or as it is in a much more complex environment. And that then gets back to what we were talking about earlier about stages and myths and stuff, where these things are always in competition with other stages, with other myths, and with other roles. And so that once all of that complication is seen, the question comes up, yeah, well, how can we understand all that stuff? And the answer, according to Plato, is very similar to the answer according to McLuhan, and that is that the medium is the message. This is to say we have to understand the ratio that is or the ratio is plural, I should say, that is possible between these contesting forms. The form of visuality and acoustics, or the form of ideality and realism for Plato, it's that ratio or that medium that is sort of the fulcrum on which any proper understanding first rests.
Oh, excellent point you're making. I don't
Thank
demur.
You.
So we might be coming near the end, so I want to move along a few quotes here.
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so the I say this was 1966. This was the last pinnacle of abundance. It's going to get cruel in 68 with Vietnam coming in and the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy after the Summer of Love in 67. I got this far before. In the mid-60s, there's an optimistic feeling about North America. But within a few years, it all goes to misery because the satellite environment starts really impeding on people. And they start having satellite video in 68, which was a big change. News agencies could show live footage from around the planet. And then I quote the article on McLuhan in 64, Planner's Paradise. you know, the, when he's presenting the new huge Center for Culture Technology as a computerized programming situation. The journalist calls it a planner's paradise. So I have here a planner's paradise. It was very naive. People accepted the experts, the actually obsolete specialists. They thought specialists knew what they were doing. It was an easy time to be a specialist. These United Nations bureaucrats had to be aware of the different biases of different cultures, but that was a bias in itself. They were trying to program the planet. McLuhan was inspired that he could program the planet because he knew the bias of all the different processes. That was his bias, but he knew he had that bias. Then I say, this is a satirical statement. Quote, McLuhan says in Counterblast, I think, the bias of our time is precisely to isolate the bias of all others in an effort at orchestration. That's our bias, and it's said satirically by McLuhan, I say. In the 20th century, every public intellectual had to offer solutions to the problems they outlined in their speeches. McLuhan is, on the surface, offering a solution, a very unique one, orchestration of the media through the global thermostat. So I stop there. And I have a quote from McLuhan.
What page are you on?
97.
Oh, 97. Okay.
Do you want to just scan the red?
Well, I just wanted to see where the orchestration quote was, because I don't think he was being satirical there or ironic. I think he sincerely believed that and hoped for that, but he realized that in order to do that, there needed to be proper focus, and we didn't have proper focus.
Right. I would say that that's a satirical could maybe mean he's quite detached about it.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, I agree with that for
yeah.
sure, yeah.
He's fully aware of the issues and problems that that statement makes that nobody else has much awareness of. Other than the United Nations bureaucrats and the CIA, they feel it instinctively.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to define
it. Yeah, it's like you could say you have a whole bunch of pieces of metal fully assembled components, right? And you can have somebody who doesn't know how to put them together but feels the imperative to do it. That can be the United Nations bureaucrat, or
yeah.
you can have somebody that knows how to build a car. Well, those are two entirely different things, but you could say they both feel the imperative. They both know that it has to be done. It's just that one has the knowledge to do it and the other one doesn't.
Yes. I think you got it, mate.
I doubt that very much. Past experience would say no, he doesn't.
Okay. I'm going on to the next quote. Scanning down to see where it's from. So I'm on page 97. I've got the Playboy quote. I think the grammar is wrong. Marshall McLuhan dash. It should be Marshall McLuhan colon because I have him in quotes. That means he's part of the Playboy interview. That's what we're coming into, a few quotes from Playboy, okay?
Yep.
So, back to 97, and we talked about McLuhan's orchestration of the media. McLuhan is on the surface offering a solution, a very unique one. Orchestration of the media through the global thermostat. So then I quote Playboy, and Marshall McLuhan says, all these convulsive changes, as I've already noted, carry with them attendant pain, violence, and war, the normal stigmata of the identity quest. Now, that's the collective identity quest, if you're saying pain, violence, and war. But the new society is springing so quickly from the ashes of the old that I believe it will be possible to avoid the transitional anarchy many predict. automation and cybernation can play an essential role in smoothing the transition to the new society. Now, this I mentioned this to a professor once in the early 80s. He said, that's fascism. McLuhan's idea of programming, you know, TV and radio and what proportions countries would have. Mm-hmm. But McLuhan understood that fascism and the tyrannies of the 30s under radio conditions were puny compared to the massive forces that were being programmed instinctively by 1969. You know, he used to say that what Hitler did was child's play compared to what people are doing today, working with massive forces and really getting by on luck. And how long will the luck last? Mm-hmm. So I was saying that.
But I'd like to go back to that professor for a minute because the ability to orchestrate the media, let's say, depends upon being able to focus the media in a way that allows orchestration. If you don't have the proper focus on what media are, then you're not going to be able to orchestrate. So when a professor says, oh, that's fascism, what that professor is saying is that proper focus is not possible. So when proper focus is not possible, the only response to that is fascism. Because basically what you're saying is there is no proper focus, but we have to focus in some way, and therefore we need to force a focus. We need to make a decision about focus, and that's exactly the fascist message. So that professor and what he said about McLuhan, specifically about McLuhan's fascism, was a kind of a mirror that was reflecting back his own fascism and was distorting the view of McLuhan's orchestration, which is precisely not fascism, which is precisely to open up the social dialogue so that through transparency and focus that is probed, we can turn away from fascism to some sort of, as you were just saying, collective identity.
Yeah, complex clairvoyance.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, well said. So then automation and cybernation can play an essential role in smoothing the transition to the new society. And
Now, what was that? That is, to me, that's a very surprising statement for McLuhan to make, and one that he wouldn't be able to make about his own family, let alone about the world going on about him. So I wonder, do you think he's being satirical there, or hopeful, or what's behind that surprising statement? Maybe you go into that.
The damage from the surgery. What's behind it? The damage from the brain surgery. Because this is after the brain surgery.
Yeah. it could be a hope that his own automation and cybernation can regain themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a shift here that might indicate a blindness in himself.
Yeah, or he may have felt that he, in the context of the Playboy interview, if he were going to make any quote-unquote headway, that he had to come across as a potential optimist.
Yes. And so when he makes that statement, the Playboy guy is shocked. How? He says, how would we do this? And Marshall says, the computer can be used to direct a network of global thermostats to pattern life in ways that will optimize human awareness. Already, it's technologically feasible to employ the computer to program societies in beneficial ways. And Playboy says, how do you program an entire society, beneficially or otherwise? See?
Right.
The guy's hung up on the fascist meaning of program, the huge
Correct.
Cliche point.
That's right. That's right.
So then McLuhan says, there's nothing at all difficult about putting computers in the position where they will be able to conduct carefully orchestrated programming of the sensory life of whole populations. I know it sounds rather science fictional, but if you understood cybernetics, you realize we could do it today. The computer could program the media, determine the given messages that people should hear in terms of their overall needs, creating a total media experience absorbed and patterned by all the senses. We could program 5 hours less of TV in Italy to promote the reading of newspapers during an election, or lay on an additional 25 hours of TV in Venezuela to cool down the tribal temperature raised by radio the preceding month. By such orchestrated interplay of all media, this is like the connubium we were quoting from page 190 of War and Peace, by such orchestrated interplay of all media, whole cultures could now be programmed in order to improve and stabilize their emotional climate. Just as we are beginning to learn how to maintain equilibrium among the world's competing economies. That's a really great point. To put it back into economics, that we're already doing it, and we don't get upset there. Then Playboy says, how does such environmental programming, however enlightened in intent, differ from Pavlovian brainwashing? So then Marshall goes in for the kill. Your question reflects the usual panic of people confronted with unexplored technologies. I'm not saying such panic isn't justified, or that such environmental programming couldn't be brainwashing or far worse, merely that such reactions are useless and distracting. Though I think the programming of societies could actually be conducted quite constructively and humanistically. I don't want to be in the position of a Hiroshima physicist extolling the potential of nuclear energy in the first days of August 1945. But an understanding of media's effects constitutes a civil defense against media fallout. The alarm of so many people, however, at the prospect of corporate programming's creation of a complete service environment on this planet is rather like fearing that a municipal lighting system will deprive the individual of the right to adjust each light to his own favorite level of intensity. Computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments to fulfill the social needs and sensory preferences of communities and nations. Now that's what the tech body is doing today. Then he says, the content, and the content is italicized, the content of that programming, however, depends on the nature of future societies, but that is in our own hands. That's where you have on page 11 of Take Today, where the form and the content merge. It's an interesting statement where he doesn't say it on page 11, but he later says art, science, nature, and media merge. The content has now become the form. They've merged. And that's what I would call the word that makes the market. The White House is now the ground for everything. And they can state that McLuhan is right and then implement it. Or they can state that he's wrong. But the White House, the automated surrogate, has the levers in their hands to manipulate the global programming. See, so this is quite an amazing quote.
Well, I mean, it is an amazing quote, but it needs to be teased apart in many ways.
Well, we've been doing that for 47 sessions.
Well, that's right. That's right.
We were explaining this. And, you know, I mentioned it to Ted Carpenter, or even maybe he brought it up. He was talking about he preferred the McLuhan, the aesthete of the early 50s. He said, I didn't like when he got into this computer talk and global thermostat and programming old environments. So that's when I left. Interesting that Carpenter couldn't take that level.
Yeah. Well, Carpenter wasn't entirely wrong that McLuhan was getting into a new way of expressing himself, and there were dangers to that.
Yeah.
And McLuhan himself admits it when he talks about the physicist in Hiroshima.
Yes.
Right? Yep. Which is a very funny kind of image.
Well, it's poetry what he says in that whole section.
It's beautiful. But you brought up a very, very important point, and that is when he brought it down to the level of competing economics.
Yeah.
What we have to understand, and you said McLuhan was showing here that what he was talking about was already happening.
Yeah.
Right? Well, In
on
fact,
the level of efficient causality.
Mm-hmm. But he was, but when he's talking about computers in the position where they'd be able to conduct carefully orchestrated programming of the century life of whole populations, it has to be understood that that programming is already occurring.
Yeah.
It's just that we don't know it's already occurring.
Yeah, so we think 1984 is coming in 84, where it already happened in 1900.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Or that it not only had it already been happening in 1900, but it's at the very basis of what human beings are.
That's right.
That we're subject to languages. We're subject to cultures. We're subject to all sorts of constraints that belong to our time. But the possibilities with which we address those constraints are not subject to time. And humans are always situated between those two things.
So yeah, and that's why I say to start demanding your freedom is damn silly. You're not looking at the conditioned environmental control of you as 50% of the situation.
Right. So whatever freedom you have comes from insight into your constraints.
Yeah. And so as we talk about this, I feel that it's quite a thing we're talking about. It's like the 1927 Copenhagen conference where Einstein and those guys got together and tried to work out what quantum physics was. And that was a significant conference. I think that what we're saying today is a very high-level translation of what McLuhan was trying to have as a dialogue with people. We're mm-hmm. doing it.
Well, I mean, one of the things we're doing is that we're saying, well, when you read this passage, isn't this exactly what's going on today in discussions about Twitter and the media?
Yes, and
right?
About
Klaus
Schwab at the WEF. They say, this guy is going to try to program the whole environment. This is outrageous.
Yeah, yeah. But people are talking about the algorithms that are used in Twitter or in Google or in Facebook to say what can be said and what can't be said. And that is sort of what McLuhan is talking about here. But McLuhan's talking about it, 50-some years ago. So McLuhan was kind of channeling where we're headed and trying to juggle in his head how that can be avoided in its in its inherent disasters and how it can be promoted in terms of its equally inherent benefits.
Right. Once talking to McLuhan through the medium Michael Blake Reed, and he channeled 6,500 to 7,000 entities called the Evergreens. I've mentioned this before. And so you can talk to McLuhan or whatever through the Evergreens, channeled by Michael Blake Reed. So I was asking about the final Armageddon, and whoever was answering in the Evergreens, I don't know if it was McLuhan, said, the final Armageddon will be when we have a technology and we know if we implement it, it becomes an environment, we will forget everything we ever knew. We know that will happen. And the Armageddon will be a fight over whether to implement that technology. So I saw McLuhan, that's arguing over to imply that that's mediocology. Do we apply this new technology? We know what it'll do to us. That's McLuhan is the final, his topic is the final argument. And that's where we're at today. We're looking at China saying, well, they got a social credit system that's horrible from Western values. Yet other people are saying we got to do that, you know, here.
But the funny thing is, of course, we already do that with
our credit systems. There it is.
And TV pollsters and political pollsters and stuff. That's all I do.
Yeah, and I would say that because we're already doing it, and therefore it's now that it's become a figure of discussion, we've moved on to something else.
Yeah, maybe, I hope so.
Yeah, we have gone past the issues that McClellan's raising. Now, Ion would say, yes, you're not going to stop this Armageddon that's coming. You've gone too far, and it's over. Just wait for if it bombs you or not.
Wait for the ball to drop.
Yeah. And okay, so we do a lot on that topic, and as I do it, I'm the only person among the group that's doing it that has these scenarios that McClellan laid out in my mind. No one else has this data. They don't have this in terms of thinking associatively about what the dilemma is today. But we're doing it ourselves right now. We're bringing up this final Armageddon about whether to implement the new thing, and McClellan starts the argument by saying, no, let's do it. And then everybody says, yeah, let's do it. And they go, wait a minute. Let me tell you what we got to consider if we do it.
Right. Well, there's doing it is itself not literal, right?
Yeah.
So that's the question is, how are we to understand doing it? And then that becomes a very complex matter.
And then that's where you say you don't need an answer. You just have to recognize the question. So
interrogate the question, probe, yeah.
Yeah, so the complex clairvoyance would be that everybody, McClellan got the podium, laid it all out, and was sent to all embassies out of the United Nations, and then the embassies told the school people, and they told the colleges, and then they told the students. We have the question.
But notice one thing that is very important for anybody to understand in McClellan is that he had a great confidence in the human ability to figure things out.
Yeah.
So if you think, for example, of the literate revolution in Greece, what happens is that people, there had already been systems of writing, but they had not worked out some of the problems that the Greeks were able to work out. And that simplification that the Greeks were able to bring to language then sort of generated the Western tradition out of itself. So for McClellan, that became a kind of archetype for the human ability to figure things out.
Yeah.
And he thought that now we'd reached a point where we were able to figure out media.
Yeah.
However,
he said, we now know the creative process that creates culture.
Correct, correct. But it shouldn't be forgotten that McClellan is very well aware that when people were able to figure out, let's say, geometry, right, they were looking at the different kinds of figures, the different kinds of land plots, and realized that there were ways of interrogating this field of geometry that led to all sorts of interesting conclusions. When they initiated that process in Greece, it was still growing in McClellan's own time. And he often talked about non-Euclidean geometries. So when McClellan thought that something could be figured out, he didn't mean that there was suddenly a total illumination. What he meant was that there was initial insight into the focal objects of interrogation, and then those focal objects could be interrogated forever. So there's a kind of not knowing, ignorance, built into our knowing. And our knowing then keeps on interrogating or exploring ignorance to figure things out.
Very good point.
So you have this dialectic in McClellan between the great confidence in human mind to figure stuff out, but the knowledge that if it figures it out, it will then only initiate a process that goes on forever.
Right. Now, that's where on the side of humans figuring out, that's what Marshall saw in art. The great artists solve the problems by laying out the new century ratios in their art form that prepared you for what the problems that were coming. So humans solved it with the products of great art. You know, that was a sign that art, humans could solve it, because artists showed up and solved it. Nobody understood that's
art,
what they were doing.
Art there is the archetype of making.
Yeah. Making solutions or creating coherent consciousness.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
I think we can end there because it's getting late. It's time for you to attend your dog, right?
Well, now we have another dog, so attend to the two of them. Absolutely.
Why do you have another dog?
Well, it's our son's dog, and he's traveling, so we're just looking after him.
Right. It's not permanent.
No.
Okay. So good. We got to – did you just laugh there?
No. I just said good.
Yeah, okay. So we're at how do you program entire society? And then he says that he goes down to Venezuela. Okay, then Pavlovian. So we got to page 100, the top of 100, with the italicized content. Now I want to read the blue intervals as I popularize the depth of the quote. I do a verbal thing. So when we go back next time, when we come back, I'll do the blue parts from page 97 to 100.
Yeah, perfect.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think we are saying something that humans should hear, but they've never heard before, how we're talking about this.
Yeah, well, I'm learning as we go, enjoying it, and I hope we're clarifying some of these difficult and important points.
I think we are, and no one's ever heard this. They didn't know there was a problem, and they didn't know you could come up with a solution.
There you go.
Which is stating the problem clearly. You call it
absolutely.
A question. Okay, great.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Cameron. And let's hope that it all got recorded.
Yes, sir.
Okay, talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.